Good evening. Veterans Day is observed in the United States, the legacy of a century of war. Are we nearing a constitutional crisis over the vote? An expert says maybe. And COVID rears its head as the city takes cops off the case for disturbed people. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, November 11th, 2020. President Trump was at Arlington National Cemetery today for a somber, rain-soaked ceremony marking Veterans Day, a national holiday in the United States. It was 102 years ago today, at 11 a.m., the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, the guns fell silent along the American front at the River Moselle in France, marking the end of a four-year conflict that killed more than 10 million people, mostly in Europe. Courtesy of the Imperial War Museum, here's an audio recording of the last shells bursting in the seconds leading up to the beginning of the armistice on November 11th, 1918. The holiday, first called Armistice Day, marked the sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of American soldiers who fought in the First World War. It became a federal holiday in 1938 and was expanded to commemorate American veterans of all wars in 1954. That was after two more bloody conflicts. In 1941, Franklin Delano Roosevelt declared war on Japan.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
World War II was the last of the 13 times the U.S. Congress has formally declared a war, as required under the Constitution. In 1950, President Harry S. Truman announced the start of hostilities in the Korean War that Truman termed a police action.
On Sunday, June 25th, Communist forces attacked the Republic of Korea. This attack has made it clear beyond all doubt that the international communist movement is willing to use armed invasion to conquer independent nations. An act of aggression such as this, it creates a very real danger to the security of all free nations.
In August 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson announced a small exchange of fire in the Gulf of Tonkin near the coast of Vietnam that began intensive involvement in what was known as Indochina at the time.
My fellow Americans, as President and Commander-in-Chief, it is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
Historians concur there were probably no Vietnamese naval vessels in the area, and the U.S. ships were possibly shooting at a radar mirage. In 1983, President Reagan announced the invasion of Grenada, among the reasons to rescue American students at a medical college.
On Sunday, October 23rd, the United States received an urgent formal request from the five member nations of the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States to assist in a joint effort to restore order and democracy on the island of Grenada.
The Grenada invasion lasted 4 days. 19 Americans, 45 Grenadians, 24 Cubans, and up to 67 civilians, including 18 civilians killed in a mental hospital mistakenly bombed by the U.S. Air Force. In 1989, President George H.W. Bush announced the invasion of Panama.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
In Panama, about 23 U.S. forces and allied troops were killed, about 300 Panamanian soldiers, and between 500 and 3,000 civilians were killed. Later that year, President Bush announced the start of the Persian Gulf War.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak. Ground forces are not engaged. This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor, Kuwait.
In the U.S.-led Gulf War, known as Operation Desert Storm, about 300 coalition forces and up to 50,000 Iraqi troops were killed. Under the administration of President Bill Clinton, the U.S. aimed military operations against Serbia, Somalia, and bombed Iraq multiple times. George W. Bush launched the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are ongoing. Currently, casualty counts are 4,825, 4,507 Americans, and about 35,000 Iraqis have been killed. A U.S. military veteran, Christian Sorensen, is a former Air Force Arabic linguist and defense industry analyst. He says the modern military-industrial complex includes the U.S. Congress and the gradual elimination of boundaries between military and civilian authority.
It goes both ways. So industry pushes and it pulls. It pushes in the sense that it tries to locate its senior executives into the Pentagon, into the senior civilian offices in the Pentagon, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisitions and Procurement, et cetera, et cetera. And then it pulls. It keeps tabs on what senior ranking or senior high ranking generals or admirals are ready to retire. And then it goes after them and it pulls them into various positions within the war corporation, and the really good networkers, the really good schmoozers become directors on the board of directors. And then the war corporation itself leverages their knowledge to corporate profit.
Does this just favor one company over another, or is there something a little more sinister here?
In a sense, you can think of it as fascism. I wrote a column recently regarding the nature of the military-industrial congressional complex and how it is indeed fascism. Now, fascism is when the capitalist economy is deeply intertwined with government, and there are a lot of different forms and manifestations of this. Industry executives, former industry executives, functionally run the Pentagon, and how industry then recruits from retired generals and admirals. That's the sort of the first manifestation. You can see it also in how the war industry carries out most of the jobs that the troops used to do. You have an increasingly corporatized U.S. military establishment, everything from nuclear weaponry to base operations and support services to every manner of good and service sold to the Pentagon and right on down the line. There's no such thing anymore as inherently governmental job.
President Trump ordered Lafayette Plaza cleared and then marched across the plaza with General Milley and held up the Bible for that infamous photo op. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, Milley and Mark Esper both had to publicly apologize for the involvement of the military in domestic politics.
There's more continuity than anything else among the George W. Bush administration, the Barack Obama administration, and the Trump administration. You can even go back to the Bush Sr., the Clinton administrations as well. There's a great deal of continuity. Neither political faction dissents from endless war. Neither political faction stops catering to the needs of Wall Street and the billionaire donor class. Both political factions are completely fine with sending our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters, our mothers and fathers off to fight in these endless elective wars.
Would American troops fire upon American citizens?
One of the very encouraging signs in a very gloomy political morass is the fact that there are many veterans groups that want the wars to end, want the troops to come home, want the veterans to be taken care of, and want the system to start taking care of the American public instead of war profiteers. So some of these groups are About Face, Veterans Against the War, Common Defense, Left Flank, DSA Veterans Working Group, doing an excellent job educating not just veterans and not just the American public in general, but current active duty soldiers, sailors, airmen and marine, and the National Guard as well. Because the National Guard, if it does come to troops firing on the American public, it will probably be a National Guard act. So I'm encouraged because the active duty soldier, sailor, airman, marine, and the National Guard are increasingly politically aware. Those who will be asked to fire upon the American public are increasingly likely to refuse that illegal order.
U.S. military veteran Christian Sorensen is a former Air Force Arabic linguist and defense industry analyst.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. State officials and election experts are reporting the 2020 election unfolded smoothly across the country and without any widespread irregularities, despite Trump campaign lawsuits presented without evidence claiming fraud. About 107 million Americans voted early in person or by mail, and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican, announced the vote was so close in his state they would begin a hand recount.
The next step in the current election process is getting the final county certifications in. We'll then move to the Risk Limiting Audit, or RLA. At 1 p.m. today, I will make the official designation of which race will be the subject of the RLA. At that time, I will designate that the RLA will be the presidential race. With the margin being so close, it will require a full by-hand recount in each county. This will help build confidence. It will be an audit, a recount, and a re-canvass all at once. It will be a heavy lift, but we will work with the counties to get this done in time for our state certification.
It'll be a methodical process, and it'll be an accurate process. And I'm sure that there'll be plenty of oversight. We want to make sure that both parties have the opportunity to observe this, because we understand the stakes are high.
That's for every vote.
And that's Secretary of State, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. Following Democrat Joe Biden's victory, Trump has sought to discredit the integrity of the election and argued without evidence that the results will be overturned. Most Republicans have been publicly backing the president, although some prominent GOP voices have agreed Biden won the election. Attorney General William Barr and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have claimed the president should be allowed to launch legal challenges. Yesterday, Pompeo was asked if delaying the transition to a new president could harm or endanger U.S. interests.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly.
Pompeo made the statement with a grin, leading some observers to comment he was really speaking tongue-in-cheek. In other words, joking. The chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College, Professor Alan Hirsch, has written The Short History of Presidential Election Crises. Hirsch says he believes the United States could duck a constitutional crisis. Until now.
We might be. Originally, I thought we probably weren't, because the margin of victory was wider and more certain than it was in those two other situations. But now that Republicans seem not to be accepting the results, and there has even been talk of pressuring state legislatures that are controlled by Republicans to substitute electors for those won in the election, it seems as if there is a chance. I don't counsel panic, but I think there's concern that we may be entering a crisis period.
And what happens when the United States enters a crisis concerning its presidential elections?
It depends. In 1876, it ended up being resolved by a bipartisan commission, and then allegedly by a corrupt backroom deal that the Republicans, if they took office, would not pursue Reconstruction. In 2000, it was resolved by a partisan Supreme Court, effectively ending recounts in Florida. Neither of those are what I would call, or history judges, to be particularly happy conclusions or happy endings. Ideally, it will be resolved by the processes playing out in court and the relatively frivolous lawsuits the president is bringing being dismissed, the electors casting the ballots that they were elected to cast, and the Congress accepting those ballots on January 6th without a crisis. That's just presuming that we don't have the kind of toxic intervention by the courts, by state legislatures that don't accept the results of their state, by members of Congress when it comes down to it on January 6th. So we're really at a point where we don't know. It could be resolved the way most American elections have been resolved, by the candidate who won taking office, or there could be a tug of war before then.
Do you think there's backdoor dealings going on like happened in 1876?
So what happened in 1876 is it was unclear who had won the election. There were three disputed states in which the state sent competing slates of electors to Congress. And Congress appointed a 15-person commission to look into these allegations of, you know, who had won these three states. And the commission resolved the dispute in favor of the Republicans, not surprisingly, because there were eight members of the commission that were Republicans, seven who were Democratic, regrettably a partisan party line vote. But then the people who officially record the electoral votes and certify the election finally is a joint committee of the House and Senate. The Constitution requires this, and by statute it meets on January 6th. When that committee met, it was not clear that the Democrats were going to accept the results of the commission. And if they don't, you really have potentially chaos. You could have had two dueling inaugurations. But allegedly, I think it's fairly clear to historians that Rutherford B. Hayes and the Republicans told the Democrats in Congress, look, go along, accept the findings of the commission, accept the electors for the Republican, Hayes becomes president, and in exchange, he pledged not to pursue the Reconstruction policies that had been the Republican Party's approach, to withdraw troops from southern states that had been occupied. So it really was resolved by a bargain, whether you call it corrupt or not. I think there has been no suggestion that that kind of negotiating is taking place yet. I certainly think it would be premature to do so because the process may play out without any need of such intervention, but it would be inappropriate in any case. The presidency is not supposed to be achieved by some backroom bargain. It should be transparent.
What was the effect of this backroom bargain in 1876, and what could be the effect if such a thing happened now?
Well, the Republicans were elected. Rutherford B. Hayes took office. It was not accepted by the Democrats. They called him Rutherford Fraud and his fraudulency, but he did take office, and he did, in fact, reverse the aggressive Reconstruction policies of the Republican Party. So arguably, some really bad things happened as a result of this deal. I think right now we need cooler heads to prevail, recounts to happen, litigation to be resolved, and then we should all hope that the legislatures simply implement the vote of their state. And if that happens, Joe Biden will be president.
We're still waiting for all the ballots to be counted. Where do you think this is heading?
I'm optimistic that it will resolve in a normal fashion. I'm a little nervous that there will be shenanigans in some of the legislatures. I'm less nervous, but open-eyed to the possibility of courts intervening improperly. But I think right now there's cause for concern and vigilance, but not alarm.
Professor Alan Hirsch is chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College. He's author of The Short History of Presidential Election Crises. And even if Biden makes a smooth transition in January, there's questions about his foreign policy. Mary Amney Everett is an intern at the Institute for Public Accuracy and radio presenter with World Radio Paris, where she hosts the podcast Hidden Paris. She's written the article Biden, a War Cabinet, for Counterpunch.org. She says the candidates in line for top military and intelligence positions in a Biden administration are well-known war hawks.
I have been studying Biden's record and more specifically the records of these three people that I cover in my article, Tony Blinken, Susan Rice, and Michelle Flourney, all of whom were vocal supporters of the Iraq War at the time when it was being debated whether to invade or not because of the supposed presence of WMDs. We obviously now know didn't exist at the time, and we now know that. Yes, it's very possible that Trump presidency versus Biden presidency or any other presidency before that, yes, hasn't changed that much because we had the Iraq war, which obviously began under the Bush administration, but then it continued under the Obama administration, of which we obviously know that Biden was the VP. It continued under the Obama presidency, and then it continued under the Trump presidency. These presidents have stated that they're going to try to pull out troops. Having these people around you in a potential cabinet, it's very possible that, yes, not much is going to change in regards to foreign policy, at least for perhaps the Iraq war under Biden.
Flournoy, who is she and what job would she get, do you think?
She did begin under the Clinton administration. She drafted the Quadrennial Defense Review, which basically was a document that stated that the U.S. would be able to either threaten or use military force if they feel threatened, which triggered the Iraq war, as we know, because the U.S. at the time was like, oh, there might be WMDs over there. We feel threatened. Let's go. Even though at the time you had to get UN permission to go to war, this review allowed them to bypass that. She is possibly being considered as a Secretary of Defense in a Biden administration.
I'm just curious, like who these people are. Who are they going to be when they get into power?
Judging by these records, it is possible that even if we don't have a new war, we could be continuing this war. Perhaps I've spent too much time in Europe because I am an American living abroad. It's funny when people remind us that 9/11, the attacks were supposedly caused by Saudi Arabia, and yet we attack Iraq. A lot of people ask me, like, how does that make any sense? And obviously the reason at the time was for oil, right? So it is profitable to continue this war.
And Mary Amney Everett is an intern at the Institute for Public Accuracy and radio presenter with World Radio Paris. We were discussing Michelle Flournoy, who was the principal advisor to the Secretary of Defense under President Obama, involved in the formulation of national security and defense policy and oversight of the military. She is in line to be potential Secretary of Defense in a Biden administration. In New York, Governor Cuomo announced new coronavirus restrictions Wednesday, including a cap on the number of people allowed to gather in private homes and a curfew on bars, restaurants, and gyms. All businesses that have a state liquor license and gyms must close by 10 p.m., the governor said. The rules go into effect on Friday.
We're taking several actions today. If you look at where the cases are coming from, if you do the contact tracing, you'll see they're coming from three main areas, and we're going to act on those three areas. First is bars and restaurants. So we are going to have a requirement that statewide SLA licensed, State Liquor Authority licensed establishments close at 10 o'clock. What is a state licensed facility? It's a bar, it's a restaurant, overwhelmingly is the majority of it. Bowling alley with a liquor license, but it's about bars and restaurants. And that's one of the main spreaders of COVID. In theory, indoor dining, outdoor dining, you're at a table, you only take down the mask to eat or drink, but what happens is that setting, it's very hard to police. It's very hard for people to maintain the discipline of sitting there eating and drinking and chatting and having a good time and laughing and keeping a mask on. And bars and restaurants are one of the identified spreaders. So they will close at 10 o'clock. A restaurant can do curbside food only pickup after 10 o'clock. But food only pickup after 10 o'clock. Second, gyms have to close at 10 o'clock. The gyms are also an identified spreading element. So it's bars, restaurants, gyms.
And that's Governor Cuomo. Staten Island Councilman Joe Borelli blasted Cuomo's newest restrictions on indoor family gatherings ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday, declaring he'll gladly flout the changes. And in more news that's controversial among uniformed first responders, First Lady Shirlene McRae announced a new program today that has trained mental health professionals to go on calls with emergency medical technicians when 911 is called about an emotionally disturbed person.
This is the first time in our history that health professionals will be the default responders to mental health emergencies. Treating mental health crises as mental health challenges and not public safety ones is the modern and more appropriate approach. And that is because most individuals with psychiatric concerns are much more likely to be victims or harm themselves than others. Of the more than 170,000 mental health calls to 911 last year, and I'm going to repeat that number, 170,000 mental health calls to 911, an estimated one call every 3 minutes, the majority concerned people who just needed help. Our goal overall is to prevent these crises from happening, but when they do, we want to provide better and more compassionate support. That's why we have retrained tens of thousands of NYPD officers in crisis intervention, helping them to better recognize signs of emotional distress and how to de-escalate tense situations. With these mental health teams, we will test the model where we relieve police officers of those responsibilities, which in many cases, they should never have been asked to shoulder.
And as First Lady Shirlene McRae, on October 26, Walter Wallace Jr., a 27-year-old African-American man, was fatally shot by police in Philadelphia. Wallace's family stated that Wallace was having a mental health crisis. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, November 11th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.